From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Boko Haram seizes a Nigerian military base. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak. Search continuing for Air Asia Jet in the Java Sea, plus a new U.S. Congress beginning work this week. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Suspected Boko Haram militants have seized a military base in northeastern Nigeria in the town of Baga. Local residents said the armed Islamist group overwhelmed troops after an hours-long battle at the facility near Lake Chad. The base is used by a multinational task force mandated to fight transnational crime and incursions that include soldiers from Nigeria, Chad, and Niger. Kenya's high court has suspended some of the more controversial measures in a national security law following a challenge from opposition lawmakers and a rights group. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports the ruling last Friday affects restrictions on the media and refugees, as well as new powers granted to the police.
High Court Judge George Odunga suspended 8 clauses in Kenya's Security Law Act pending a further hearing. Among the clauses was a provision that granted the police the right to detain suspects without charge for 360 days, a measure imposing harsh fines on media outlets that broadcast images deemed offensive by the state, and another clause that put a limit on the number of refugees allowed in the country. Opposition lawmakers and the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights brought the challenge against the law to the High Court. KNCHR Commissioner Suzanne Shatika Chivusia told VOA some of the provisions were oppressive and in violation of the Constitution, noting the restrictions on refugees.
The import of that is that some would have to be taken back to places where their life could be under danger. I don't know how implementation of that law would have occurred, because either way it would have violated the rights of a genuine refugee.
Kenya already hosts more than 500,000 refugees, mostly from Somalia. The new law would limit the total number to 150,000. The initial bill was passed in mid-December during a chaotic session of parliament in which lawmakers threw punches and tossed papers on the floor of the National Assembly. Chivusia says the law was approved without enough public input or time for lawmakers to debate.
If we are going to allow flawed processes to result into enactment of the legislation, that is going to be a very dangerous precedent.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, who signed the law shortly after it was passed, has denied it violates the Constitution and has said all the amendments are in the interest of national security. The ruling Jubilee Coalition pushed for the new security laws to combat the rising threat of terrorism in Kenya following attacks claimed by or attributed to the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. In the worst attack, Al-Shabaab fighters assaulted Nairobi's Westgate shopping mall in September 2013 and killed more than 60 people. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Suicide car bomber in Somalia's capital Mogadishu has killed at least 4. Security Ministry spokesman Mohammed Yusuf Osman told VOA security forces had surrounded the car near Mogadishu's international airport when an Al-Shabaab militant detonated explosives in the vehicle. Al-Shabaab group claimed responsibility for Sunday's attack. The Islamist group has recently escalated attacks around Somalia's capital. In Sierra Leone, a 5-day Ebola lockdown in the northern Trincoli district was extended Sunday for another 2 weeks. The government has also imposed additional screening measures at Freetown International Airport after 2 workers apparently came down with the deadly virus. U.S. Senator Chris Coons, who is the leading Democrat on a Senate subcommittee on Africa, is just back from Liberia. He appeared Sunday on the CBS program Face the Nation.
We've got some great news, something about which all Americans can be, should be proud. I went to visit our 2,400 troops from the 101st Airborne Division and to see the work that they've done, and they've done remarkable work. They and the doctors and nurses of the CDC and the Uniformed Public Health Service have really turned the corner on the Ebola epidemic in Liberia. But I'm calling for a change in strategy by the Pentagon. We can't declare mission accomplished and withdraw too early here. We can bring home 1,000 or more of these troops now. They're currently bored because they've accomplished a lot of their mission of building infrastructure, building new Ebola treatment units all over the country, deploying new military testing labs all over the country, and setting up a vital infrastructure. The raging epidemic that threatened the whole country in September is now down to a few embers scattered across this country. But we need a new strategy to adapt to conditions on the ground. Our troops should remain, some of them, for the rest of the year to help make sure that Liberians can transition our emergency Ebola treatment units into community-level health clinics and transition our high-tech military mobile testing labs into Liberian-run local labs so that going forward, this epidemic really is brought to an end in Liberia.
Senator Coon says he's being monitored for any signs of Ebola. And in the United Kingdom, a British nurse who contracted the virus in Sierra Leone is fighting for her life in a London hospital. Pauline Caffrey's condition is now listed as critical. And a German hospital has admitted another possible Ebola patient, an unidentified South Korean health worker who was injured by a needle while treating a particularly ill patient in Sierra Leone, one of the country's worst hit by the current epidemic. Dr. Ulrich Frey is medical director of the Charity Hospital in Berlin.
This person was admitted to our isolation unit and will be now supervised with the question whether or not the person will develop symptoms of Ebola or not. In this moment, there is no proven infection.
Patient in Berlin will be closely monitored as long as the virus may be incubating. That could be up to 3 weeks. A U.S. healthcare worker who was possibly exposed to the Ebola virus in Sierra Leone was to be placed under observation at a hospital in the U.S. state of Nebraska. The medical director of the biocontainment unit at the University of Nebraska Medical Center said the unidentified patient is not ill and is not contagious. Meantime, the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, is launching a campaign to inform and fight the stigma surrounding Ebola. Some patients who survive face rejection by the communities in which they live. Some are sharing their stories on a mobile app, hashtag #ISurvivedEbola. It is funded by U.S. philanthropist and co-founder of Microsoft, Paul G. Allen's Foundation, which has committed $100 million to fight the disease. International Federation of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Society says while progress has been made in ending the Ebola outbreak, much more needs to be done to prevent a relapse. More than 20,000 cases have been reported, with more than 7,900 deaths in all. VOA's Joe DiCapua has more.
The Red Cross's Catherine Mueller gives an assessment of the Ebola epidemic in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
The Ebola outbreak is not under control yet. We do see some leveling off of cases for Liberia, for example. However, we've seen it before that somebody attends a funeral, they come back, they're infected, they infect their village, and cases spike. So it really doesn't take much to have another increase in cases.
Mueller is the IFRC's Africa Communications Manager. She worries that people may become complacent after hearing that the number of new cases has slowed in some places.
That's actually one of the things that we're concerned about, is once people in the country start seeing this leveling off of cases, that they're figuring, yay, we're beating this thing, and it's too early to say that. This is the new normal of living with Ebola, that it's just not going to go away.
Part of the organization's efforts include going to remote areas in the three hardest-hit countries.
So far, our volunteers have reached almost 3.5 million people with their messages about how to protect themselves and how to stop the spread. We're having some success, but we're also finding that still a lot of those messages are not being heard. So we really need to figure out how to talk to these communities in a way that they'll understand and actually implement the messaging. Talking with the religious leaders, the community leaders, people who are really well-respected, traditional healers, and getting the messages shared by them.
Mueller says some of the major obstacles to raising awareness are fear and mistrust, both of the governments and some Westerners.
A lot of them had never seen white people before. So white people came in when Ebola came in, and communities are connecting the two, and in a lot of cases are blaming the Western aid workers who are there for bringing Ebola into their communities. So those are some of the challenges that we're up against.
And there are logistical challenges.
We definitely do not have enough beds to be able to support all the people who would need them. What we're also noticing, though, is that there's this geographical spread of the virus. So we go in and we set up a treatment center in Kenema, Sierra Leone, for example, and then the virus has spread to other remote communities. And that actually makes it harder to manage, because if we move the resources from one area to another, cases start spiking in that original area.
The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is asking its partners to expand their operations in the rural areas. Mueller says amid the crisis, there are success stories.
People are surviving this disease. At our treatment center in Kenema in Sierra Leone, we've had more than 200 people discharged from the treatment center. Now, not all of them have been confirmed Ebola patients, but a good majority have been. We've also had local nurses who have survived, and they're now actually coming back and joining the Red Cross, and they're volunteering at the treatment center to look after the children who can't be together with their parents who are also at the center.
The main goal is to reach zero Ebola cases in West Africa. However, she says, it's important to start talking about investing in African health systems, training medical personnel, and greatly improving access to health care. The IFRC has called a meeting for the end of January to begin planning long-term operations in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In less than a week, human traffickers have abandoned two ships carrying hundreds of migrants, many of them from the Middle East and North Africa, seeking asylum in Europe. Both incidents occurred off Italy's coast. VOA's Al Pessin reports.
In both cases, all the crew members had fled, leaving the ships on autopilot heading toward shore. That forced the Italian Coast Guard to rescue the passengers and bring them into port. The traffickers' new tactic appears to be a response to Italy's decision to end Operation Mare Nostrum, which had more patrol boats farther out at sea. Traffickers would put the migrants in small boats or life rafts, and the patrols would rescue them. Professor Emeritus John Salt of University College London says by withdrawing the patrols, the Italians appear to be sending a message that so far migrants and traffickers are ignoring.
By withdrawing, as they have done from the Mare Nostrum operation, they're sending the message that you aren't going to be rescued, so don't come. That is a longer-term solution, because there are already quite clearly people in the pipeline who are going to come anyway. I think it remains to be seen whether in the longer run the new policy will deter or not.
Italy now relies on a European Union agency called Frontex, which has far fewer resources for responding to the flow of asylum seekers and fewer patrol boats. Traffickers who charge high prices to transport illegal migrants to Europe appear to have adapted by steering their ships toward shore, putting them on autopilot and then abandoning them. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Weather improved today, and divers are attempting again to locate large objects on the ocean floor, believed to be the fuselage of AirAsia flight that crashed more than a week ago, killing 162 people on board. In previous days, bad weather had delayed efforts to find the plane's black box recorders that may explain why the Airbus plunged into the Java Sea. According to a National Search and Rescue Agency operational officer, Suprayati, the black box was located near the tail of the plane, which is yet to be found. Indonesia's meteorological agency said seasonal tropical storms probably contributed to the crash of that AirAsia jet. Also in the news, a new study has identified the pollutants that are causing the marble of India's Taj Mahal to turn yellow. The discoloration of the white marble has long been a concern, but the latest study could help in drawing up more targeted measures to protect the 360-year-old monument. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
The 17th century monument is located in the busy industrial city of Agra in northern India. Many have long blamed air pollution for discoloring the famed monument. But the year-long study by two American universities, an Indian university, and the Archaeological Survey of India has now identified the specific causes. To carry out the study, researchers placed small samples of pristine marble on the Taj Mahal, left them there for 2 months, and then analyzed the particles deposited on their surfaces. One of the study authors, Professor S.N. Tripathi at the Indian Institute of Technology at Kanpur, says the particles come from multiple sources.
We have an increasing fleet of diesel vehicles nowadays in cities. Large vehicles, trucks, that's number one. And that is a major emission source for black carbon and organic carbon. But biomass burning, and particularly, you know, the season now we are seeing, and because of power outages and other stuff, and people, when they feel cold, they burn any kind of stuff. So people maybe in houses, they are burning just some kind of, you know, wood, etc. But outside, people are burning cow dung. And different kind of trash burning is also becoming a major source for organic carbon.
Activists have been warning for several years that Agra's air pollution is making the Taj lose its sheen. Over the last decade, authorities have banned vehicles within 500 meters of the monument. Efforts have been made to supply clean fuel to industries and improve the power supply to lessen the impact of diesel generators. But despite these measures, a 2010 study found that the relentless growth of industry, population, and traffic had only worsened air pollution in Agra. Preservationists are stressing the need for more targeted protection of the monument. Conservationist Ratish Nanda in New Delhi says some weathering is to be expected in a monument that is over 360 years old and believes that the single issue of discoloration should not be blown out of proportion. However, Nanda stresses the need for far more intensive monitoring and greater involvement of the scientific community and more funding to protect the Taj.
There are a lot of studies which are sort of saying that is the discoloration happening and how is it happening and so on. But there's absolutely no real work on what to do to prevent it.
Since 1994, authorities have been giving the monument a mud pack treatment to remove the pollution stains. Modeled on a centuries-old beauty treatment used by women, it involves plastering the monument's surface with lime-rich clay and then peeling it off. The Taj received the treatment for the fourth time in June last year, but experts warn this too could have unwanted side effects. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Thousands of police officers and mourners from around the United States gathered Sunday in New York to honor Wenjian Yu, a policeman shot to death last month in a targeted attack. 28-year-old man killed Yu and Officer Rafael Ramos before shooting himself at a nearby subway station. The shooter had written on social media that he would kill police officers because he was upset about several incidents in which unarmed African Americans died at the hands of police. Washington witnesses a transfer of power this week as Republicans take control of the U.S. Senate when a new Congress convenes. VOA's Michael Bowman reports with majorities in both houses of Congress, Republicans face a dual task, advancing their core beliefs while also working with President Obama, a Democrat, during his final 2 years in office.
They came to power in an electoral wave. Republicans soon to be sworn in as senators.
We go to work to fix a Washington that is out of step, out of touch, and out of time.
Among those who will flex muscle on Capitol Hill, Senator-elect Tom Tillis, who says chronic gridlock in Congress will ease under unified Republican leadership.
Just to be able to take matters coming from the House and from the Senate and sending them to the president's desk is something we haven't seen for several years. So I think by just focusing on getting Congress back to function, then we can start doing things that'll heal the economy.
But the Republican legislative agenda is loaded with items to undo, limit, or overhaul President Obama's proudest accomplishments, like health care reform. While the president says he is eager to work with Republicans,
the American people just want to see work done here in Washington.
Vice President Joe Biden says the Affordable Care Act is working just as intended.
We have finally ended the debate in this country of whether or not health insurance is a right or a privilege. We think everyone in America has a right to have adequate health care insurance. And the Affordable Care Act gives them that right.
Many Republicans also object to the president's recent executive orders benefiting millions of undocumented immigrants and relaunching diplomatic ties with Cuba. However those battles play out in the coming year, Republicans say they are looking ahead to the next presidential contest. Senator-elect Ben Sasse.
So we need to demonstrate an ability to govern. But we also need to admit that the big challenges facing this country aren't going to be solved in the next 24 months. We need to set the stage for a 2016 presidential election.
Democrats like Senator Chuck Schumer are also pondering the next electoral cycle.
If we put together a strong economic message aimed at the middle class, not only will it unify our party as the Republicans are truly divided, but we can actually do really well.
The coming week will focus on the ceremonial transfer of power on Capitol Hill. After that, the arduous work of governing begins. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
And now VOA's Jerome Sokolowski, who looks back at 2014, which might have been a particularly fearful year for many.
Evil forces around the world want to harm Americans every day. Ann Kirkpatrick consistently votes with...
America's national security threatened. Warnings of Islamic...
The NIH saw its budget...
Negative campaign ads in this election year played up the advances of Islamic militants in the Middle East, as well as the Ebola epidemic. But retired Episcopal bishop and columnist Gene Robinson says the bigger threat to America was from the fear-mongering itself.
It's especially... disturbing that a nation like the United States, which is unprecedented in its power, unprecedented in its resources, can live in such a fearful state.
This ad against texting while driving is an example of how fear can be harnessed to improve public health. But at a recent conference of medical and other anthropologists in Washington, Doug Henry of the University of North Texas said the quarantines imposed on aid workers returning from Africa failed to do that.
What we have seen, unfortunately, in this epidemic is that if you have just fear and just fear messaging in the absence of any kind of self-efficacy messaging, in other words, messaging that shows people how to handle a response, it can actually have very maladaptive social behaviors. So driving the epidemic underground, mass panic, hysteria.
Great nation will endure.
Fear has played a role before in American politics. In 1933, President Franklin D. Roosevelt gave his inaugural address in front of the Capitol and declared,
"The only thing we have to fear is fear itself."
Popular comedian Jon Stewart maintained that in 2014, the news media magnified the danger.
If you've been paying attention to the news lately, you might have heard we're all going to die.
You know, there's always a level of uncertainty and fear in any culture.
Gregory Button of the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, points out there's no mass hysteria over car accidents, one of this nation's leading causes of death.
Cultures selectively choose which social problems they're going to focus on, and sometimes it seems irrational.
While political ads and media played up foreign threats, surveys showed Americans were much more concerned about job security and the economy. Jerome Sokolowski, VOA News, Washington.
Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and chief of the social media site Facebook's adding something new to the site. He's created a Facebook page called A Year of Books because he's going to read a book every other week throughout the year and has urged his friends to join him in the project. As of late Sunday afternoon, it had more than 100,000 likes. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Aidanuq Koo, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On January 5th, 1757, French King Louis XV narrowly escaped death at the hands of would-be assassin Robert Damiens. The king survived with only a slight wound. Damiens would be tried, convicted, and then gruesomely drawn and quartered in a public execution. On this day in 1779, American naval hero Stephen Decatur was born. He's best known for the role he played in defeating the Barbary pirates of North Africa. The pirates had attacked non-Muslims for years, often taking Christian hostages as slaves. The pirates ran afoul of the American government when they began raiding U.S. vessels and holding their crews hostage. In 1876, German statesman Konrad Adenauer was born. In a public career that spanned 60 years, Adenauer is best known as the first chancellor of post-war West Germany, an office he held for 14 years. In 1914, the Ford Motor Company announced it was doubling the size of its minimum wage for its workers to $5 an hour and trimming its workday to 8 hours. Higher productivity resulted, forcing many competitors to follow suit. On this day in 1933, construction began on one of America's most famous bridges. It would be more than 4 years before San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge would open to the public. Also in 1933, America's 30th president died. Calvin Coolidge, a man of few words, was often referred to as Silent Cal. In 1940, Edwin H. Armstrong demonstrated FM broadcasting in a long-distance relay network via 5 stations. Later that year, a part of the radio spectrum was reserved for FM, which would become the dominant method of radio transmission in much of the world. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Corruption affects countries around the world. Its forms and impact may vary, but the results are corrosive nonetheless, undermining democracy, stifling economies, thwarting justice, diverting resources, and ruining the futures of nations. The moral and practical costs of corruption are no longer debatable, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. Corruption drives instability, popular protests, and revolutions. In some cases, these popular movements produce democratic reform, but in other cases, they produce a power vacuum or an authoritarian backlash. Frustration with corruption can also drive insurgency movements and be exploited by terrorist groups to gain popular support. And the proceeds of corruption, which are often sheltered in banks or shell corporations in Western Europe and the United States, enable terrorist financing and sustain unaccountable regimes. And that is why the United States is using every tool at its disposal to advance its anti-corruption agenda. Addressing corruption is tough, but we are using a range of tools and often working with other states and international institutions to encourage and assist anti-corruption activity, said Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. So we are pressing other states to live up to the international anti-corruption commitments they've made. The United States is also enforcing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and providing some $600 million a year to build the capacity of foreign governments to combat corruption. Still, said Undersecretary Sewell, the biggest factor in the success or failure of anti-corruption efforts is a matter of political will on the part of governments. The willingness to use the power of the law against the biggest violators, regardless of who they are or what political party they support. We renew our notice to kleptocrats around the world. Continued theft from your communities will not be tolerated, and the international community is committed to denying safe haven to you and your illicit assets, wrote Secretary Kerry. We call on partners in government, civil society, and the private sector to join us in fighting corruption. We also call on countries undergoing democratic transition to redouble their efforts to build governments that are accountable to citizens and respect the rule of law.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.